Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds ideas to the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Vigor, a branding and advertising agency focused on the restaurant and hospitality industry, and by Quench, a food and beverage advertising agency that specializes in evolving iconic food and beverage brands. Learn more, visit vigorbranding.com and quenchagency.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Fork Tales. I'm Michael Pavone. Our guest today is Clara Pei, and I've known Clara for a long time. She is from Unite Foods. Unite's line of nutritious bars are built around the concept of global flavors, but also comfort foods. Clara has started a brand that's redefining what protein and nutrition bars can be, and I'm happy to have her as a guest. Clara, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
So again, I know you, I think, pretty well, and I'm excited for this. This will be fun. So I want to go back. I mean, you have a fascinating story. So before we get into Unite, I want to talk about you. How did you, where do you come from? Where did you work? Talk a little bit about what got you here.
Well, it's definitely not been a linear path. It's been really a path led by my own curiosity in the world. And so I think if I'm anything, I'm a very curious person. I'm curious how the world works. I'm curious why, segments of the population aren't being served. So my journey really started, undergrad. I went to USC and I really went undeclared and thought I wanted to be a lawyer and got into one political science class. And I was like, no, I definitely don't want to do this. And so kind of was looking around like what else is out there, found the business school at USC, and more importantly, found the entrepreneurship program, which was number one in the nation at the time. And, and I knew I didn't want to study accounting or finance. And that's what business was to me in my mind back then. And finding this entrepreneurship route really like kind of opened up the world to me and was like a light bulb. My dad is an entrepreneur. We immigrated from Africa in the Sudan when I was 5 years old. And in Africa, he had an automotive parts distribution business. And when he immigrated to the US, he started a plumbing manufacturing and hardware distribution business. And so, having a dad that had kind of modeled entrepreneurship, it was demystified for me. And so I was like, oh, that's really interesting. I've been an entrepreneur kind of since I was a little girl, whether, the classic lemonade stand or selling popsicles or, drawing pictures and trying to sell them to my aunts. Like, I always had that entrepreneurial start. And, funny, but like at USC, I remember them taking a poll of all the entrepreneurship kids and how many of them had like a lemonade stand or something similar as a kid. And it was like 95% of the class raised their hand, right? Like it's something almost innate where, that entrepreneurship bug grabs you as even a little kid. And so, going into the entrepreneurship program, it was kind of like, I equated to like TED Talks, where you just got to like hear and listen to these really successful entrepreneurs that had launched, and they were normal people with good ideas that they just implemented. And I thought I would, be an entrepreneur straight out of undergrad. I wrote a business plan and for the apparel industry back then. I'll date myself, but I graduated in 1999. And then 1998, 1999, I wrote a business plan for plus size clothing for teenage girls. So I saw that there was this huge segment of the population where kids were kind of, Americans were growing in size, and there weren't really anything fashionable for young girls to wear if they were plus size. They had to shop, especially in jeans. They had to start in, shop in the women's department or the boys husky department. And there really wasn't anything fashionable. And I wrote this great business plan. All my professors told me to do it. And like the only person I knew that had any money was my dad, being 21 years old or barely 21 and asking him to fund, I needed like $30,000 back then to launch this business. And I was going to do it with my best friend, whose father had just invested in a jeans manufacturing plant. She had done the entrepreneurship program the year before. It was like this home run idea. The internet was just coming online and we were going to do it all online. We didn't need storefronts. We were kind of revolutionize all these things. And my dad's like, what? Huh? Like, that's from the plumbing products. Like, this is a business that already exists. And he just didn't see it, didn't understand. But it's ironic, but like that business would grow on to be like that segment specifically, where I did all my research at this mall, like went on to become a $1 billion business. Like Torrid went into the same brand mall with the same concept. And so that was kind of like always in the back of my mind, my entire career. So from age 20 to now, like, gosh, like why I should have done that. Like I should have done something like that. Why didn't I try? And I'm telling you a really long part of the story, so we can edit this, but it's really like,
oh, it's great.
You know, for me, it was really about that early experience in entrepreneurship that I held on to, but then I would go on and work in cosmetics, worked for advertising agencies, you know, and then eventually my dad lured me into the family business, which was like, you know, about 5 years after college, I wanted to get my MBA and he said, hey, I'll make you a deal. You and your best friend, why don't you come work for me? Get your MBAs and I'll pay for them. And you just have to stay the time that you're studying. And, you know, we did this executive MBA program where we worked our 9 to 5 and then we went to school from like 6 to 10. And those are long days, but they were really fun because I got to take what I was learning in the MBA program and immediately apply it to my family business, which was, again, the plumbing and hardware distribution business. And so not that I was in love with plumbing and hardware, like, trust me, if I never see another supply line in my life, it'll be too soon. But it was really about this unique experience that I got to learn and apply. And it was just really, really what set me up for, like, you know, in that curiosity to like really make an impact in my family business where, you know, sometimes when you join a family business, you get told, well, this is how we've always done it. So this is why you have to do it this way. And for me, I got to kind of redefine everything because of this MBA program that I was doing. And my dad trusted, you know, he always had a high regard for education. And so was like, okay, well, yeah, let's try it. And really got, you know, got in.
That's fantastic. I mean, you bring up a really interesting point though. Being a sibling of an entrepreneur, you kind of do realize, or maybe you don't realize, that it's not easy, but you know, it's doable, right? If you watch your father do it, like my father had a couple small sporting goods stores. So I thought, well, if you want to start a business, you just go out and start it. You just do it. And, you know, in my story is I've never been smart enough to know what I can't do. So I'm like, oh yeah, I can do that. And just, you know, and you sometimes you pass, sometimes you fail, but you know, it's like, oh, I can try that. Oh yeah, I'll do that. So, but I think our parents really do make it easier for us if they've done that, you know, and you sort of, I don't want to say you take it for granted, but it's sort of like, it seems doable. It seems attainable, you know, and next thing you know, you've got something special. And I'll say this, it had to be interesting, difficult, and maybe very educational for you being a young woman in the plumbing supply distribution business. I mean, what was that like?
You know, it's a very old industry. It's, you know, very much like, there's very little product innovation. And so for me, being a curious person, I was always trying to learn. I always wanted to go to like plumbing school. So like I could like learn about the products a little bit more because they're actually really complex. And if you ever go down a hardware store aisle and you go down the plumbing fittings or the plumbing section, I mean, there's literally thousands and thousands of SKUs and so many different parts to like toilets and, you know, faucets. And it's a very confusing, you know, you have to have like a lot of deep knowledge in the industry to really make an impact. So for me, you know, I knew I was never going to have that. Right? What I could bring to the table was really an outside the box way of thinking about this industry. Like, you know, we created the company's first website and started selling, you know, online and really trying to quantify customer experience, right? Like it wasn't just about like place, you know, filling orders. It was like, what was the experience of that order for your customer? And so I've always been a customer centric leader. So I think it's because I came up through marketing and entrepreneurship. You know, I really care about the customer and I really care about like the person that's opening the box, whatever that box is, you know? And so for me, it was all about aligning the business to be customer focused because my thesis was if you focus on your customers, they will reward you with loyalty. And if they reward you with loyalty, your revenue will grow, right? It's a win-win. Mm-hmm. If you create value, why would somebody leave you? So it's when you're not creating value and you're creating problems for the customer that, you know, you have that attrition. And so for me, it was really about making sure that we were taking care of our customers. And that was the winning strategy. I mean, it sounds really simple, but it's way harder to execute when you get to scale.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it makes total sense. So basically you do all your own plumbing now. Is that what you're saying?
Not at all.
I knew that. Okay, so now let's jump into something that I know you're very proud of and should be. You founded Unite, okay? And so let's talk about that. You founded in March of 2020, right? In the middle of that thing called the pandemic with COVID. Obviously, that was a part of the story. That's what sort of infused the story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Unite, you know, I'd been ideating on it for like probably a year and a half before that and really trying, you know, it was working in the plumbing business at my, you know, the family business that I was kind of like stuck behind my desk. And especially when I became a mom, like I was always just like looking for quick fuel to get me through my day. And that was like kind of when I had the epiphany for Unite. And really our main point of differentiation is that we use global flavors. And so I had this unique experience, again, just like the plus size clothing, where I was like, wait a minute, like, there's this whole population of people out there, like half the population are immigrants, people like me, or people that are just like really interested in other cultures and really interested in other foods. You know, I live in LA, like there's, you can eat Thai, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, whatever you want, any time of day you want, you know, it's all, you know, and that's what makes America unique, is that we are this melting pot of cultures. And it very similarly, I saw this demographic shift where, you know, America was just going to continue to grow in multiculturalism. And so I was like, okay, if you're in wellness and you are diagnosed with something, like for me, it was a gluten intolerance, like, and you go and try to find diet compliant food and you go to the shelf and like nothing resonates with you, like that's a huge miss. And so I think it was because, you know, I'm not, everybody that has created protein bars up to that point wasn't diverse, didn't have the life experience I had. So I just kind of used my own life experience to develop it. And I developed them in my kitchen, like really, like, you know, as I got my Cuisinart out and was like, what would I put in my protein bars? And for me, it was like almond butter and dates and, you know, let's sweeten it with all natural things. And I can't use sugar alcohols or stevia. Like I just, they're not palatable to me. So I just use natural things and literally Googled what do nutritionists say should be in a protein bar and like made those my macros. Like it's not that hard. You know, you don't have to like spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to figure it out. And created my first recipes and found a co-packer to make them. And I knew, you know, because I didn't want any food liability, I wanted a really strong co-packer to be the producer for them. Found one that, you know, where they saw the vision, they understood what we were about and supported us and got our product launched. And you know, Expo West was this trade show, you know, it was a trade show in the food industry. It's the largest natural products convention in the entire world. And if anybody hasn't been to it, just imagine seven convention centers all smashed together in Anaheim, hundreds of thousands of people, like 3,000 plus exhibitors. It's literally and figuratively like Disneyland. Like it's just, it's a zoo. It's, there's so many people. And we got our little 10 by 10 booth and at the, you know, they have this like new products part of Natural Expo that opens a day before we used to. And we got our booth set up and we were ready to rock. We were going to go show our bars. We had this whole warehouse full of new bars to show buyers. And that's how I was going to get people excited. And then the pandemic. And that was the first thing to get canceled. And literally we got this call, like show's not going to happen. So break down your booth. And, you know, I have, it was like such a wild time. And people were really, you know, unsure of what was going to happen. And, you know, brands were not able to get into stores to pitch or any buyers, everything kind of went on hold because every grocery store was worried about safety for their employees and how to keep cleaning products on shelf and Lysol wipes. And like, nobody was really thinking about like protein bars, right?
Right.
Like, all
right.
Kind of, you know, that's what, like, I think we all were baking banana bread every day, sourdough, and, like, you know, consoling ourselves with chips and margaritas at, you know, noon. So. Yeah.
Well, I remember like for us, I mean, you know, one of my companies is Quench, which is a CPG food and beverage. I said, you know, COVID was truly the greatest sampling program in the face of the earth for food and beverage. If you made a product at that time, if you had an established product, you people bought it, people ate it, they put it in their pantry, they stacked it in their shelves. I mean, it was phenomenal time for food. I mean, unfortunately, it was, you were too new, right? You couldn't even take advantage of it. You didn't get a chance to get out of the starting gate. So that had to be extremely disappointing. But I think it's amazing too. Like, okay, so you come from one industry and you learn a lot just in business and dealing with people from one industry, but then you applied to this startup that you were never in the food business. So you had to learn how to be a manufacturer. You had to learn about safety. You had to learn about ingredients, legal and everything and anything. I mean, it's just it's an amazing undertaking. How did you learn so much?
You know, like business is a framework. So once you understand product liability, you understand how to insure against it, right? And you learn that, you know, you have to look, what are the certifying bodies in your industry, right? Like in, you know, for electrical companies, it's like UL listing, you know, in food, it's SQF. And it's not like the information isn't that hard to find. So I think it's like, you know, once you have a framework of how it's, you know, the product is a widget almost, right? Like how you deal with Lowe's is how you deal with Target. Like it's a big box. They care about many of the same things, right? You have to understand what's going to happen on the back end of your business. You have to understand how to get that product there on time and in full. And that's what matters to them. And so I, you know, it's hard and it's not. And so for me, I've always really relied on my network, Michael. Like if I don't know the answer, I know somebody that I know must know the answer. So I spend a lot of time, I don't want to say networking, but like, I think it's really about building relationships, like mutually beneficial relationships.
Sure. Trust.
And when I got into the food space, I was like, I just need great advisors around me. I need people. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want like consultants. I wanted people who were also running their businesses.
Sure.
Who were going in the trenches, doing it.
Skin the game.
In real time. And so, you know, having a YPO forum of YPO, you know, food CPG people was like one of the ways that I accomplished that. And like really creating a forum of people around me that were doing the same things I was. And, you know, there's a lot of symbiotic experience there. And we all got to go through COVID together. So it was something I did early on. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like grabbing people who wanted to go on this journey with me. And so, you know, I think networking is like kind of like a bad word sometimes. Like people think it's like you're using people when you say networking, but if you're doing networking right, you're actually creating value for other people first, right?
That's right.
And that's how.
Absolutely. All right. So now let's talk. You created you had a product, you got shut down in COVID. So let's talk about the Unite name. You created a brand, and I'm a big brand guy. You know that I love brands and I love what you did here. I love the name. And I'm not just saying that because you're here, but this is something I did not know. I read an article and I read about the I in Unite. I should have looked and realized that the lowercase I, but so talk about the brand and how you came up with the name.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, it was all about what I was trying to do. So this is like the mission part of like this journey. When like you're over 40 and you create a new business, usually you're not doing it just for money. You're really doing it because you feel like something's missing in the world and you want to make the world a better place. At least that's my journey. And for me, it was like, how can I use food as this instrument of inclusion to like improve the lives of people, see people who haven't been seen, welcome them into wellness, right? And kind of create cultural bridges, right? Where like somebody who, I think food has this unique way of binding people, right? Like it's the cultural equivalent of bringing your dish to a potluck and like, you know, kind of like, do you like it? You know, kind of like having that, like, you know, there's a moment where you're like, are you sure? It's kind of a little strange. Or like, you know, when people used to come to my home and like, be like, you know, my mom made this thing, you don't have to eat it. It's, you know, you might not like it. And then people loving it. And you're like, oh, okay, it's good. Like it's safe. Like everyone's accepted now. And so I think for me, it was like, how, you know, food can also divide people. If people make fun of somebody's food or make fun of flavors, you know, and I think it also can unite. And so I wanted to use it as like, you know, let's find common ground. Let's find flavors that like will resonate with lots of people. And so like the flavors we choose typically are not just like country specific, they're like region specific. So like, you know, churros are eaten in Spain and Mexico and like all over Latin America, right? Baklava is eaten in North Africa, in Greece, in Russia, in Croatia, right? Bubble tea, which sounds like just an Asian flavor. And yes, it was born in Taiwan, but, you know, like the British drink milk with tea. The Indian people drink milk with tea. And the Middle East drink milk with tea. Like those flavors can resonate with lots of different people. Yeah. So, and then there's peanut butter and jelly. And that's the one where people are like, huh? Like, you know, that's not global, but it's like my American heritage is just as important. And so I want all people to feel represented. And the reason the I is small is I think because if you're trying to connect two sides, you yourself have to get smaller to understand the other side. Mm-hmm. And so that you know, to understand the other, you know, and we live in such a time of division. And so like really having a name like Unite, it's like, it's really the essence of the brand is to, you know, seek to understand and seek to find common ground instead of like how we're different.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I mean, you obviously have a propensity for marketing. It's very smart and very sound, the thinking behind it. And I've had the products that are fantastic. And again, I'm not just saying that your products are absolutely delicious. So you should be very, very proud of that. You know, and now, so we talk about the flavors. So we do a food trends presentation every year and we always come up with all these funky flavors and we I shouldn't say funky. We learn about things that are popping in different parts of the world and starting to, you know, bubble up and you know, we try to grab onto them. I mean, all of us as manufacturers, as restaurants, as marketers, and we try to understand these flavors and how to bring them forth and introduce something fresh. How do you go about finding flavors? How do you go about deciding what the next flavor is going to be?
It's really intuitive for me, but like, you know, my hero flavor is churro. And like that one was really, you know, born out of, you know, I live near Disneyland. I live like 15 minutes away and I have small kids. And so we were always at Disneyland, always the line at the churro car was kind of like around the corner, right? And like churro was like definitely this very familiar flavor. And like churros are, you know, they're eaten, they're not just different for different sake. Like many people have had a churro, like whether it's at a fair or at Disneyland or at a carnival or, you know, like churro was like not that outside the box for most people. And it was very approachable. And so like that Disneyland cart, you know, just like looking at the lines, I was like, yeah, that could be a really good flavor. How come nobody, you know, hasn't really done that? And then, you know, I would visit ethnic markets a lot to look at the flavors. Sure. So I go to Hispanic markets, I go to Korean markets, I go to Japanese markets. You know, I live in an area again where I'm blessed by diversity. And so I study, you know, when I travel, what are people eating? What do people enjoy? And the first flavors are really like things that I loved. So I just wanted to create things, you know, flavors. And then I tested them on my friends. And I probably made like 15 or 20 different flavors before I started. Right. Like, and kind of like chose the heroes from the ones that I made in my kitchen.
Now, is there one that you loved and thought, oh, everyone's going to love this and didn't make it? Is there a flavor that you kind of,
yeah.
What is it?
It was a green tea matcha flavor. And so, but green tea powder sometimes can be fishy and like sounds so weird, but like it just didn't work in scale. Right. And so, and there are matcha bars out there, but I never think that they taste great. And so, you know, I wanted it to have like good product integrity. And so like, that was like a, you know, one that like I thought would be, you know, cause if you look at the Starbucks menu, like so many, you know, those are great flavor cues too. Like, you know, Starbucks spends a lot of time in flavor development. And so you can take cues from adjacent industries.
Sure. We got to work with a lot over the years through Quench. We'd worked with the Hershey Company and we worked with the scientists. And I was always blown away because we'd go in this would be like early 90s. We'd go in these rooms where they have to swipe a card for the door to open. It seemed very like sci-fi, you know, and it'd be lab technicians and they'd put drops and be like, here, taste that. What does it taste like? I'm like, well, I taste apple pie. They're like, wait for it. I'm like, oh, I taste whipped cream. Wait for it. Oh, I can now taste crust. Like they could do this. I mean, it was like better living through chemistry. They could do all this stuff. And what it came down to obviously was, and this is what is so hard with what you do is now you have to source the ingredients. Now you have to make sure it's not a chemical thing. And then you have to understand, can you afford that flavoring at a price point that will be palatable to the consumer? So there's so much involved in all of what you do.
There is so much. Like, look, all business is hard, but the food business is particularly hard, right? Because it's a living, breathing thing, right? And for me, it came down to simplicity. Like I always wanted simple ingredients because I wanted people to be able to understand what was going into the bar, right? Like I wanted it to be real food and natural. And so when you have those kind of like barriers, you know, it helps you and it hurts you, right? Like I can't put in a bunch of processed things, you know, like many large companies can, because that's not the brand value that I'm trying to create or the kind of product I'm trying to create. So yeah, it's very hard. You know, we do get a lot of those scientists taking pictures at our booth every year at all the expos. And so we have been copied, you know, and that's like just anytime you're successful at something, people are going to copy you. And so, but I think at the end of the day, consumers want authenticity. They want, you know, brands that are creating products that are meaningful to them and, you know, align and will reward those brands. So I don't really worry about like copycats. I worry more about when they stop copying me.
Well, you know, but to your point, and, you know, we've been doing a food trends report for over 15 years. And what you are doing and how you're doing it is very on trend. It's not easy. It's not inexpensive. I mean, you could have cut corners along the way on your product, but you don't do that. And I just think that that's going to pay dividends in the long run. I think that's it's hard to stick to your ethos, but I think you do a fantastic job of that. So I think it's something you're proud of. And so my next thing is, I did not know this, but the I in Unite stands for invite. And I did not realize on the back of every bar, there's an email address that people can send directly to you for suggestions on new flavors. Have you learned anything from these? Have you gotten anything interesting in the emails?
Yes, I love those emails. Like those emails come to me. And so I get to interact with the people that write those emails and, you know, the most meaningful ones are when people will give me a flavor suggestion, but then they'll also say, well, thank you for making a bar for us. You know, thank you. And it's exactly what I wanted to do when I set out was like, make the invisible feel seen. And, you know, I know what it's like to not feel seen. You know, I know what it's like to like kind of be in the shadows, like being a woman in the plumbing industry, perfect example, right? Mm-hmm. Like you don't really belong here, or you don't like, you know, somebody that looks like me typically doesn't work in plumbing, right? Like it's a very old, you know, antiquated kind of industry. And so like when I get those emails, I get really excited, and people do have some great ideas and ideas of like things that we've actually developed, you know, and just haven't launched. And, you know, so it's fun to know that like it is also on trend for people.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, I'm being Italian. My wife's Greek. So Yaya, her mother, makes us baklava. So it's phenomenal. So I'm really proud to see that you have a baklava in your flavors. So you have baklava, you have peanut butter and jelly, you have chiro, bubble tea, Mexican hot chocolate. What's your favorite?
You know, it's like asking me which my favorite kid is.
Oh, we all have one. Come on. We all have one. On any given day, we all have one, a favorite kid.
I mean, Churro is our hero. And Churro was like the first bar where I was like, okay, we really have something. Yeah. But I really also very much like baklava. And it's similar to Churro in that, you know, it's got kind of like some of the same kind of spices with the cinnamon. Mm-hmm. But baklava has never been done outside of baklava. Like, mm-hmm. think about it, Michael. Like, you've never seen a baklava ice cream. You've never seen a baklava cracker. Like, you've never seen a baklava popcorn. Right? Like it was very unique. Yeah. And, you know, before I launched, you know, many of the manufacturing partners I met with in the beginning were like, these flavors are too strange. Like nobody's going to buy mm-hmm. these. Like to be, you know, have come full circle and be like, no, they're great. And like baklava just won a Good Housekeeping Award this year from their, you know, Best Snack Award. Churro won the same award last year. So it's like, it's incredibly validating when, you know, people like the product and like, you know, appreciate it. And it's got organic honey in it. It's just really tasty bar.
That's great. Well, like I said, the products are amazing. And in a way, I look at these flavors and in a way they're kind of all comfort foods too, right? I mean, they're all international flavors, but they're almost like international comfort flavors, you know, it's just, it kind of feels that way.
Well, they're nostalgic flavors. So the flavors that you ate in childhood.
Right.
And so that was also really important to me. Those were always also one of the barometers is like childhood flavors. And ironically, I mean, I didn't develop these for kids, but like kids love our bars and like, duh, they're childhood flavors, right? Like they're really for adults. But, you know, so we've had this like wide range of like consumer interest in our products. And so for me, it's like about taking you back to kind of like a simpler time. I think, you know, health food specifically is sometimes punitive. Like, oh, I don't really like this mushroom powder, but I'm going to drink it because like my podcast said that I'm going to get muscles if I drink it, you know, and I'm like more on the other side of wellness, but like, let's make it fun and let's make it like food you want to eat, not food you have to eat.
Yeah. That's great. All right. Well, let's have some fun here. So, you know, being the research guys that we are and the marketing guys we are, we came up with our own flavors. So we decided to go around the world. I want your opinion on if these are going to be, winners or not. So we'll start in India. Gulab Jamun. It's a very popular dessert. It's often served during celebrations. It's fried dough soaked in a rosewater syrup, often garnished with almonds and cashews.
10 out of 10. I think that would be like a home run flavor. I've actually, you know, my Indian friends have also suggested that exact flavor. And it's always kind of been in my mind. The rosewater is the one that's like, can be polarizing. So, you know, we try to have things that are like, you know, broad appeal, but yeah, I think 10 out of 10 would be a great flavor.
Plus I'll say this, I hate to be the total American here, but pronunciation can also be a barrier to people buying something if they can't figure out how to say it.
Right? You know?
All right. Now we'll head to Spain. Creamy caramel flan.
I love flan. And I think flan is another one of those foods that's mistaken for like just Latin Americans because lots of people eat flan or, you know, it's called sometimes creme caramel. It's called like different things in other regions of the world. You know, so yeah, another great flavor. You guys are good at this. Don't start a bar company.
We would never. If we, you know, they're yours. These are all yours if you want to do them. So we have some friends, we have some employees in Brazil. So, Bolo de Rolo. It's a light sponge cake. It's rolled up with a layer of tangy guava jam.
This one I've never heard of. I've never had. I've not been to Brazil, so it really piqued my interest. I love guavas. I think tropical fruits, you know, we see that in beverage now. You know, there's all kinds of great beverages that have popped up with tropical fruit flavors. And it, definitely in terms of global flavor trends, guava, I think, is still underrated because I love guavas. So, yeah, I think, you know, it'd be interesting to get the sponge cake kind of consistency in a bar, because bars are tend to be a little bit drier and a little bit harder to make soft because water stability issues. But I think that super intrigued. I want to go to Brazil. So that's on my list.
Well, there you go. Those are an excuse for R&D. It's a write off. You know, that's fun. Okay. So we go to Italy, for some almond biscotti.
I mean, I love biscotti, but I think if you're craving biscotti, like eat a biscotti.
Yeah, I agree. You know? Yeah, I don't think that works in a bar, right?
Well, you know, like people tell me like, oh, you should make a hummus flavored bar. And I'm like, what? Like, why don't you just eat hummus?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, exactly. For me, it's about taking something, because biscotti is not unhealthy, like typically. Like, no. You know, if you had one, it's like, it's fine. It's like a treat. You know, so I typically try to take like higher calorie, higher density things to make them healthy and approachable. So
yeah, you're almost bringing a dessert together to a degree,
exactly.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. And you know what's funny? You said something that really kind of stuck with me. The beverage industry does do a lot with flavors, and it's really kind of accelerated. I mean, as a company, we were early on with flavored beverages in the tea category. And we had a brand that we worked with for like 15 years we helped build, was called Turkey Hill Iced Tea. Excuse me. And it was the first refrigerated tea. There was teas out there that were shelf stable, but we were in the refrigerator. Well, the proliferation now of beverages in the refrigerator, you go to a convenience store, it's just walls of beverages. So there's a lot of unique flavorings that you see popping up. And I guess that would be a good place to see, I don't know, what's acceptable, right? Like what are consumers interested in?
Yeah, I think it's a good, again, like I got take a lot of flavor cues from like a Starbucks, or like, you know, what are people drinking, and like, what are the flavor cues in beverage that we can borrow from, right? Or that can inform some of us. I think in beverage, it's a little bit easier because the flavoring is just like drops added to something.
Yep. Yep.
Like you're trying to really create something authentic in food, but gosh, I'm just happy I have a shelf stable product. Like I can't imagine distributing a refrigerated or frozen product. Like knowing what I know now, it's like just a whole nother level of anxiety.
Yeah. Well, and flavoring too on that side is, it's amazing how, if you add some flavor, sound obvious, add some flavor to it. Like what happened to potato chips, right? So we have in the snack food category, we have snack foods. I mean, adding just a new flavor, a new fun. It's amazing how much velocity you get and how much traction. And we actually did it across the tuna category. And you would think, you know, tuna in a can. We started adding sriracha or different types of hot or Thai chili, or I mean, just all these kind of unique flavors. And it's amazing how it can really get you more shelf presence. And it also then it creates an atmosphere of trial. So it's an awful lot of fun for that too. So so as an entrepreneur who's growing and developing a brand, that's still a relatively young brand, you just created 4 years ago. What are some of your biggest challenges?
You know, it's sad to say, Michael, but like there's a lot of predatory behavior for emerging brands in the food space, right? Mm-hmm. Where I think this industry like depends on the churn to a certain degree of like brands to fail, like to come in to shoot their shot. And like when they fail, it doesn't matter because there's like so many other brands behind them trying to get in that same shelf space. So I think it's just being the underdog. Like if you look at the shelves that we're on, we're competing with behemoths, right? Like billion-dollar brands, multi-billion-dollar brands, like that control the entire food supply. And we're like on the same shelf. And like, how can we actually compete to build brand awareness? Like, you know, so you just do it with a radical authenticity. You do it by creating value for the consumer, creating something different, creating a better product. But it's really like having come from a larger company where like, you know, you have some kind of street cred because you are larger and it's easier to grow a larger company, but to grow from scratch has been like humbling. Like there's a lot of people who want to put their hand in your pocket, who want to, you know, take advantage of you, and you have to be astute. And again, you have to surround yourself with people that are smart, that will help you avoid the landmine, help you clear those paths. But, you know, I also started a nonprofit called Included for, you know, people of color in food CPG, just because I feel very passionately, it's called Included CPG, for people to kind of like not make the same mistakes that I made, or kind of try to pay it forward somehow by clearing the path for, you know, I don't want people to, you know, make the mistakes that we've made or could have potentially made.
That's you've always been one to give back. And I think that's very admirable. I mean, we were walking around, and was it this, we were just talking about with the included CPG, we were walking around, I think it was Expo West. You had a special section, and you had them donate space. What was that for?
Yeah, it was for emerging brands.
And oh, okay.
No, for included. And so we do that at the Fancy Food Show and at Expo West every year. And so we kind of run kind of a mini incubator accelerator for these brands and help them get that big space and be ready to pitch. And, you know, you have to be market ready. So it's not like for a brand that's like pre-launch. It's like, you know, you have some kind of like established brand presence and really hoping to elevate them to the next level, because those trade shows are so expensive and it's so prohibitive. And so anything that we can do to level the playing field to like help an emerging brand win is like, it just lights me up, Michael. Like, it makes me so happy, because these are the people improving the food systems. These are the people that are bringing healthy products to market. These are the people who are, you know, taking their family recipes and trying to share them with the world.
Well, I mean, I admire you, because you're able to, I could see you walking into those shows and asking for them to give you all this space. And I know how you are. You do it with a smile, but you're pretty emphatic, and I'm sure you always get your way. Because I know I sit in meetings with you, and when I miss a meeting, I have to answer to you. But you do it with a smile, but you always hold people accountable, and you get what you want. And I do respect that. So,
well, I mean, it's been a great partnership with New Hope and the Specialty Food Association. And it aligns with their values. So they actually are great partners. And so it's a, you know, and it's a team. It's not just me. There's like five other founders on the leadership team have included. So, you know, we are really working hard to improve the food systems.
So what do a lot of these folks, I mean, thankfully they have you to sort of open up the door for them, literally to bring them into these shows. Like, what do you see a mistake made by wannabe entrepreneurs? What do they do wrong? Or what do you think in the brand creation process? What do you think that they do wrong a lot?
I mean, it's probably something we did wrong too, but it's like trying to pretend you're a big brand when you're not, right? Like, yes, you can get on that shelf, but are you ready? Can you support it the same way a big brand does? Do you know all the levers to pull, right? And it's hard to say, like, it's hard when the opportunity knocks not to take it, right?
Sure.
So it's like that discipline of knowing, you know, what is the actual contribution margin of this account? And, you know, is it just like, or does it accomplish something else? So I think it's like biting off a little bit more than you can chew. And then the one that I pay attention very closely to is quality. I think quality can sink your company so fast. You know, one quality issue, one co-packer issue, one whatever issue. So if you're not paying attention to your product, you know, so closely, that can really be a landmine, because you can always create more brands. But, you know, if your brand name is like tainted, it's hard for you.
Right. I mean, some people might not even know, like, that I think people assume because you have a brand that you actually make it yourself. And, you know, there are co-packers out there, and a lot of brands use co-packers, and you're handing off your baby and your promise. You know, a brand is a promise, your promise to the consumer, to someone else to make. Obviously there's checks and balances there, but there's places along the way that you have to count on a lot of partners. And I'm sure it's a difficult business, you know?
I think you have to think of your co-man relationships as kind of like your investors, because they're investing their line time, their energy, you know, to develop your brand as well. So it is a partnership. You're not just like, you know, taking and giving, right? It's truly a partnership if done right. And like, yeah, I like to actually preface a lot of my buyer meetings by saying, hey, by the way, I don't make this in my garage, you know, because like the bias is, if you're like an emerging, I have a dream person, you're like making these bars in your garage and like packaging them up and sending them out. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but like when you're trying to pitch a Fortune, you know, 100 company, they got to make sure that, you know, you have your ducks in a row. And so that's a good qualifier.
Yeah. Target doesn't want you like to think you're baking the night before. That's funny. But it's true. And it's amazing all of the hurdles, I'll say, that you have to go through. So you have a great, there's a quote that you like to talk about a lot. Winston Churchill, success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. And you're always enthusiastic. You want to talk a little bit about some of those things that you had to bump up against, some of your failures, some of the things that you had to pivot?
Oh, there's so many, Michael. I mean, every if it was easy, everyone would do it, you know, like sure. I would say that, but it's like, it's so true. And like, you know, and every entrepreneur I talk to in the food space or any space, it's like, you got to be able to take those hits.
Oh yeah.
And get back up. But the getting back up is really hard, mm-hmm. right? Especially when there's like, you could do something else with your time. You could do something right. else with your energy. And that's where like mission becomes really important. It's like, what's actually driving you? Because if it's money, you'll give up. There's way easier ways to make mm-hmm. money. Like if I wanted to go make money, I'd just take my money and invest it in real estate or whatever. I'm like, yes, you do that too. But it's really about mission for me. And so what drives you to like make the world a better place, have a lasting impact, create products that resonate with people. And so success is just a barometer. It's just an outcome of you living that up. But like, you know, there are times, I mean, I think if you're not ready to throw in the towel every month in your business, are you even an entrepreneur? Like, right. you know, like it's just, it's the getting back up. And it's like that loss of enthusiasm is what gets you. And like another way to say that is like burnout. If you've burned out, it's too late. So I make sure that I don't burn out.
Yeah, that's very smart. That's actually very sage advice right there. Because look, these businesses, no matter how exciting they are or how long you've been doing them, you do hit those troughs. You do hit the burnout phases. I mean, personally, I started my first agency 33 years ago. And it's, you know, and during this whole time with COVID, there's so much change. And you know, you think like, well, you've been doing this for a long time. Everything should be on autopilot. No. I mean, I probably worked harder in the last couple of years than I did maybe in some of the middle years. I don't know. It's just a different time. So yeah, the entrepreneur thing, I think everyone takes it for granted, or everyone looks over and says, oh, you've done that, or you have money because of this. And most people don't realize those days and those sleepless nights and those weekends and the fears of everything from bankruptcy to lawsuits to everything else. We all go through it, right? I mean, I'm very fortunate. I get to talk to a lot of founders. I get to talk to a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of successful people. And they all have those same stories. Every one of them has that nightmare. Like, yeah, there was this time when, and you know, you didn't think there was a tomorrow. So it's good to hear, right? Because your story, you've seen it all the way around from your father to starting up now and what you're doing. And I love that you stick to your guns because again, you can cut corners. You could do things faster, cheaper, but not better. And I think that what you do is really remarkable. And I know it's going to pay off in the long run. So what's next for Unite? I mean, is there any new flavors? If you can't talk about it, I understand, but is there anything new products or flavors or anything exciting on the horizon?
Yeah, there is a new flavor. It's called Hot Fudge Sundae. It'll be launching soon. And so we're really excited about that flavor. Another nostalgic awesome. Childhood yep. treat. Also some different, you know, we're looking at different formats, kind of some adjacent things. So definitely an innovation pipeline out there. So hoping to launch some other products, but really I want to win at bars first and, mm-hmm. You know, really own our category and really, you know, make sure that our velocities stay up and everything is good with bars.
Fantastic. All right. So one last question, and it can't be one of your bars, but if you had one last final meal, what would you eat, where, why?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I'm a California girl, so it'd probably be an In-N-Out cheeseburger.
There you go.
Right. You know, and
I like, respect that answer. That's a great answer.
Yeah, some French fries and a good steak.
Animal style, I hope.
Animals for sure. Animal style. You know, it's kind of like that's the meal when we travel abroad or something, and you get back, you're like, oh, I just want an In-N-Out burger. Right. You know, just it feels like home, and I think that goes back to nostalgia and childhood too.
Anybody that with work or whatever, friends or family that travel with me, they know when I land in California, that's one of the first things I do, and I will not leave until I do it. Like, so it might not be the very first thing I get to do if I have a meeting, but I will have In-N-Out before I get on that plane to fly back east. So that's a great answer. Great answer. So anyway, Clara, thank you. This was awesome. I appreciate you. You know, I've known you a long time, and it's just so cool to hear your story and see what you're up to, and congratulations.
Thanks, Michael. It's fun to be on.
Awesome. Thanks.